Today, we are welcoming a married couple, both writers, but we're going to talk about a book by Daniel Grandbois that just came out. Today, we're talking to Irene Villar and Daniel Grandbois. Irene Villar is an editor, a literary agent, and an author of several books dealing with national and generational trauma and women's reproductive rights. Daniel Grandbois is the author of the Indy Next Notable Book and Believer Book Award Reader Survey Selection Unlucky Lucky Days by Boa Editions, the art novel The Hermaphrodite, an hallucinated memoir illustrated by Alfredo Benvenides Bedoya, and the omnibus Unlucky Lucky Tales. He holds an MFA in poetry from Bennington College, lives in Colorado, and tours extensively in North America and Europe with the band Slim Cessna's Auto Club. Welcome to the show.
I'm holding this, the beautiful book of Unlucky Lucky Tales, which is a sequel, I take it, from your first Unlucky Lucky Tales.
Unlucky Lucky Days.
Yeah. I know it's part of a series, and we'll get to that later. But I really love the pieces. They're playful, and they're meditative, and they're serious, but they're also whimsical as well, and you seem to put all of these things together really well. But one of the things I'm curious about, and I really love the illustrations by Fidel Sclavo.
Yes.
They're really incredible, and I think they really add something to the book. They add a kind of feeling or a kind of atmosphere, ambiente, to the book, which I think is really lovely, because they're also whimsical, and yet he's a quite serious artist. And also there's some loneliness in this book as well. So I was going to ask you about how you put together that, because I think that you really want to talk about human experience in a different way than a lot of writers are doing today. Can you talk a little bit about that? I don't even know if you're even really working in a genre, in a defined genre, anyway.
I don't even really know genre. I just write what I write. And in fact, these things that many people call prose poems, when I first began writing them, I didn't know there was such a thing as a prose poem. I just wrote what I wrote. And it's the same with talking about the different ways it might present the human condition. It's not something that consciously is set forth, that I set forth to do. It's just, you know, what comes out. And, you know, luckily I have Irene here reading everything I write daily and helping me shape that a little bit and helping me, have confidence in that voice and in what comes out. Because she really has the editor's brain that I lack, and I might not, you know, I might be able to stir these things out, but I might not have the confidence to put them out there without her.
And are you comfortable if someone would say, this is really a book of short fables, would you be comfortable with that kind of label?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with any label. And it's the same with the band I play in, Slim Cessna's Auto Club. No one knows what to call it, and there's a million different labels. And I'm happy with any label, whatever works for you. And to me, it doesn't have to be short stories or prose poetry or what people call PP/FF, which is the line in between them, or anything else, or fables or fairy tales. It has all of those things. You know, I guess the only time you really need to distinguish a little better is if you're teaching in front of a class and you're trying to make a point or something and you're trying to fit it into this area or that area or that line between. But
I got your first book, Unlucky Lucky Days, which came out with Boa. And Boa used to only do poetry. And in fact, this was the first time I learned that Boa had done, I don't know if we can call it fiction. And I noticed a lot of their collections. I've since read some of their collections. A lot of them are like this. But how does this Unlucky Lucky come about? Because I know you have this one, and then you have your very latest one, which is put out by Texas Tech Press. But how did this unlucky lucky dichotomy come about?
And there's even more unlucky luckies, because this book is made of three books: the original Unlucky Lucky Days from Boa Editions, and then the one that I wrote after that, Unlucky Lucky People, which really became my MFA thesis, and then Unlucky Lucky Book. So we just kind of put them all together and made that.
Originally you were going to go with three separate books. Now that you mentioned it.
Yeah, and Pitt Poetry Series, which is the best publisher for prose poetry, they have Russell Edson and David Shoemate, and their editor Ed Ochester, who did the foreword, ended up doing the foreword to my book, was going to take on Unlucky Lucky People, but then as two big name prose poets, Russell Edson and David Shoemate, both turned in they both turned in manuscripts.
Oh, no.
Irene jumped in and said, well, let's put them all together and make one nice book. And that's also what the reason for the illustrations is, because Irene's series, The Americas, is all about the, you know, kind of collaboration or influence between across the Americas. And my book would not have fit there unless we got a South American illustrator, and so therefore had the conversation between us.
I'd like to ask Irene a question now. Can you tell us first a little bit about the series that you edited? It's a wonderful series with Texas Tech University Press. Tell us a little bit about the series and why this book fits into it so much.
Absolutely. Well, The Americas is a book series that I launched at University of Wisconsin in 2001, University of Wisconsin Press, with the motto, the mission of really publishing books, fiction and nonfiction, across cultures and historical divides. Especially, you know, books with a Pan-American spirit, basically. And so 80% of the books I was hoping to publish in translation. And so that book is a wonderful moment in the series because it's book number 50. And in a way, it's the first book that we published, even though I wanted to really publish North American and Canadians as well, who were publishing across cultures. So, you know, let's say a Canadian that went to Nicaragua and wrote a novel or something, you know. Mm-hmm. That had the perspective across the border. Somehow it didn't happen, so I ended up publishing a lot of Latin American and Caribbean authors in translation. So Dan's book is really the first book by a North American, which was part of that initial mission. And even though the content itself doesn't thematically talk about writing across cultures, it does something very interesting, which is writing across genres, and also involving the plant and mineral and animal world in ways that is seldom done, you know, and the fables really lend themselves to that very well. And in a way, then it becomes an interesting addition to this writing across. And so, and then in terms of actually the physical book, we went ahead and found Fidel Clavo, who is an amazing artist from Uruguay, who has won many, many international awards in creation of posters, especially environmental posters. And he read the tales, and he was totally taken by them and said that somehow he felt that he's sort of minimalist, subdued, magical, and how to very well explain kind of a lonely mood really lended itself well to the tales, because the tales indeed are whimsical, they're very parodic, they're very funny, and yet they have, many of them have this post-apocalyptic tone or pre-apocalyptic, you know, it's something that happens outside time, but in a way that feels very, very close to our time, and it's kind of scary. And in that sense, there's that loneliness. And so, yeah, the book, it's a beautiful, and it's my husband, so imagine. Book number 50, you know, my husband I get to publish him. So it's symbolic in many ways.
And, you know, if you were to hand me this book and say, this is a book by a Latin American author, someone from Buenos Aires, translated into English, I would believe it. It does have that kind of Borgian, Cortázar, Galeano type of feeling to it.
It does. It does. I'm so glad you say that, which again makes things so, so absurd in their own way. When you were asking him about his process and the unlucky lucky concept, you know, as a wife, I can tell you that my husband loves to read science, and he reads very little fiction, and he's a very funny person and a very funny father, and most important, he's a musician before being a writer. So he's always had issues with talking with words themselves. For him, they always feel like cumbersome and in the way. But if he hears music, you know, sounds in terms of, in musical terms, then he's totally there. But for him, I always say that he has some autistic elements. And I bring that up because you can really see that in his writing. He goes to very weird places that weird minds, and yet very brilliant minds, that, you know, you can see autistic, brilliant, you know, a lot of brilliant elements of perception in autistic people. And so I think in a way that's part of his way of approaching things. And that's why I think the surreal and the absurd fits so well, because it's a deviant and alternative way to normal communicative language.
How big, by the way, are the paintings that he did? I know that they fit on a page, and it seems as if though you've taken a photo of the paintings, and it feels like they're floating the way that they kind of put the shadow in back of it. How large are these paintings? Are they small? Are they large?
Yeah, everything has been sent in digital form, but I do remember him talking about something around 11 by 17.
Oh, just a regular page size.
Yeah, and are they for sale?
Yeah.
We were talking about creating a limited edition signed by him of each print that we're hoping to bring to this America's Latino Festival we're launching in Boulder, Colorado next year, and we're going to have an exhibit of the illustrations of the book with the book. So hopefully, yes.
Danielle, I have a question for you. You've been referred to as the Dr. Seuss for adults. I remember when I was a kid, Dr. Seuss is probably, you know, one of my favorite writers. I love the imagination. I love that he could take you absolutely anywhere and make up words and things like that. Is there some influence with Dr. Seuss?
You know, there could very well be, and there certainly is from fairy tales and folk tales of all kinds as well, and children's books. Besides reading a lot of science, I get a lot more out of those kinds of books than most fiction and literary stuff. For example, The Tales of Uncle Remus, or Kipling's Just So Stories, mm-hmm. or an amazing book called The Magic Pudding. Can't quite recall the author's name now, but...
When you sit down to write, do you tell yourself, I'm going to write a book with all of these things in it. So are you writing a book, or are you just going to write the different pieces and then just put them together in a book?
Each of those things happen at different times, in the beginning and maybe through the first half of the writing process, or even more. I'm just writing pieces, and then based on what's coming out, you know, you can see the shape of a book at some point. Like Unlucky Lucky Days had many more tales that involved animals and inanimate objects, plant life, and things like that. So at one point, it became obvious that I should organize it in those categories, you know, the people and the animals and the inanimate objects. And for a while, those were going to be the three main groups in the book, and then that led me to write, you know, okay, I only have five of people, so I got to write another one with people, or I only have...
Right.
But then it turned out that we organized it in terms of days of the week instead of those, but that was the organizing factor for a while during the writing.
What is your relationship to the title Unlucky Lucky?
There's a couple things I'd say about that. To me, that's just the definition of being alive. Basically, you know, if you're alive, you feel that dichotomy that it's the luckiest thing in the world and maybe one of the unluckiest things. and then also, just to go back to how it came up with these pieces and how it came to be something that I latched onto. The first of these pieces was written when Irene and I were on our honeymoon and we had my older kids with us. We were in Maine and we had driven a long ways from the airport. Just had their car full of groceries and then it was like nearing midnight and we reached the place we were supposed to stay in this tiny little town in Stonington, Maine, and the woman wasn't there and we had no way to get in and so we parked by this graveyard, which was where we thought her place was, and we could find her, and we thought we might be sleeping in the car with our groceries, but we started telling stories, and it was one of those situations where everyone gives the storyteller one word, and then he has to create a story. And one of them, you know, that I was given the words mansion, executioner, and turtle. And the story I made up about it, you know, everyone liked enough, especially Dana, encouraged me to write it down. And then in the writing of it, it became, you know, one of the lines was about this turtle who was an executioner, you know, having this unlucky, lucky day by the river. And so that story became called that, and then eventually the whole collection became called that, making the day into days, and then the Unlucky Lucky stuck with me.
Wow, that's a great story. We're talking to Daniel Granbois, author of Unlucky Lucky Tales, which has just came out with Texas Tech University Press, and Irene Villar, his editor, partner, and... Irene, you're also a writer. You have two incredibly successful and important books, but you're also a literary agent. You're also a publisher. I understand a mother. Do you have time to write anymore?
I'm so glad you... Well, actually, my husband, every other day he tells me, I will see you in our 50s because we have no time. And until this August, I homeschool my girls. So I usually, they just went to school outside the home for the first time this semester in their 6 and 8. But before that, I wrote at night. And what I did, and now it's shifting because I have a little bit more time, but I would divide the week, you know, 2 days of the week will be for literary representation of my authors, and 2 other days would be for Texas Tech, for reading and publishing, and then 1 day maybe to write.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's where the organization of the book came from. You have to organize your life in terms of days.
Yeah, which of those days were lucky and which unlucky?
And which unlucky is right. And Daniel, you talk a little bit about your writing process. What for you is the hardest thing about writing?
For me, it's being in a place where your head is clear. I mean, if I can, it hasn't been hard for me anymore after years of habituation, but it used to be something where the main thing I had to do was put myself in the right place. And years ago, I remember I was living in Virginia at the time, and I would walk around the neighborhood talking to myself, trying to put out all the thoughts that were going to keep me from being able to open up to the place I needed to open up to. Any worries, any concerns, any fears, any things like that. But, you know, now when it just becomes habit that you go and you sit at either your computer or your writing tablet or whatever, if you just go sit there every day, it's easier and easier not to have to clear your head and put yourself there because you're just automatically there. One of the things I do now, though, is if I get a little nervous, I've been working on a play, and that's also an unlucky lucky. It's called Unlucky Lucky Bodies. sometimes you get a little nervous about going down there and facing the page if you don't quite have any thoughts of what might be coming next. And I realize that I can fool myself into getting there by sitting at the computer first, kind of looking at a few things, looking at emails, maybe going on to Amazon and getting into some light bulbs or something, and you know, you kind of pretend like you're not actually going to get to the writing, and then I might just sneak over and open word here, and then pretty soon you're writing. And so
I want to coattail on Ben's question and ask you another question about the writing process. And this, I think I know the answer, but I want to ask this because I think a lot of people wouldn't know the answer or might be surprised by the answer. But when you write, do you oftentimes write without having any idea of what you're going to write, and then suddenly you just kind of end up somewhere?
Yeah, especially for these kind of pieces, I definitely do that a lot of the time. Almost every time I sit down, and the way I used to start them is I'd kind of put myself in the right place, and then I'd kind of look around the room. You know, one time I saw a carved piece of log, and you know, on a wall, and when we were staying in the Bahamas, and then I started writing about that, or my daughter's plastic giraffe, or I might have to flip through some pages of a book, and a certain phrase will just set me off onto something. And you know, but once you get going, you know, there are times when you then are shaping it or coming in from the outside with more ideas as to where it should go. And if I write longer pieces like this play, then yes, there are times when I come down ahead of time. I have to keep everything that's already happened in mind and have some idea as to where I might be going that day. And that might be why I was getting more nervous and having to fool myself into opening the page. So.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, what you just described is like a child just sitting in front of a blank piece of paper with crayons with no idea what they're going to do. And then they come up with these incredible, incredible works of art. And of course, when I say you write like a child, I mean that as a compliment. I mean,
I love that.
Access the imagination in ways that a lot of adults cannot.
That's what people have written about in some reviews. And also, I went to talk with my brother's teaches writing, and he was at Sacramento State. And one of his students there, when I went to talk, wrote a letter to him afterwards saying that it was like that, that everything else seems like it's, you know, adult learning and adult writing is like from the outside in, you know, with all the ideas and all the thinking, and that, you know, your brother Daniel's writing was like a child from the inside out, where you never have any idea where it's going, and yet it all makes sense and somehow creates, I think she said something about it, somehow creates things in your mind instead of just naming them or something like that. But.
Well, I think you're really able to create a world in very few words. And so in that way, is it related to the music that you do?
I certainly think the sound of it is related to the music. And you know, my ear's always been the sense that is the most on, always on, and always taking things in. I can't shut it off. So, you know, people's chewing food with their mouths open drives me crazy. I can't turn my ears off. And music has always been such a big part of satisfying that sense. And I think that, yeah, the sound of things is definitely a part of how my pieces are written.
I suppose the lyrics always go with the music if it's working well together. It creates this tone. It creates this mood. And yeah. You create this mood without music. There's just the words. And you create this atmosphere. And I think that's what a good song does. It creates this atmosphere.
That's beautiful. I like that.
And I wonder if you do that with your music. I don't know your music.
Well, with the music, I don't write the songs on the bands I play in, and I write the bass lines and I, you know, any backup vocal parts.
But those bass lines are very interesting. I think they would fit here with what he's saying, yeah.
Which was your first love, music or writing?
Well, that's a tough question because certainly the first love was music. I mean, when I was 5 years old, I got my first Elvis Presley record from a garage sale across the street. And I've been hooked ever since. I mean, I probably spend at least one day, every day of my life, I've spent sitting there like the guy in the Maxell tape ad with my eyes closed and sitting back in a chair listening to a whole album. I'm a very big music fan, and it really takes me places. And I went to an Elvis concert the year before he died when I was 11 years old, and I cried like a teenage girl the whole time. I mean, that's so much. So that's the first love. But if you talk about what I spend my time doing and what actually gives me the most, fills me up the most, gives me the most satisfaction, I mean, I go on tour with this band. You know, recently we did 100 days of touring within a year, and it is wonderful while you're performing. The rest of touring is kind of a grind. But there's something that I get much more from my daily writing, and so I would have never expected it. I didn't turn to reading or writing until I was in college. I wasn't a reader at all, so it wasn't something planned or expected or desired, but it somehow turned into the thing that somehow worked best with my natural voice and my natural abilities. And with even with my personality, I'd rather be sitting at home in my room, you know, thinking thoughts than sitting in a van crossing Europe and not getting sleep and not eating what I want to eat. You know?
We've been talking to Irene Villar and Daniel Grandbois, and they're married. They're both writers. Are you guys ever going to work on a book together? I mean, write it together.
We write so differently, but we have told each other many times through the years that we have to write some children's stuff together. And this summer, we tried, like, for one night, I handed her something, and then she wrote something. And we each got inspired by it, but, I mean, it looked like there were some real possibilities there, and yet and maybe it goes back to the busy schedules and trying to fit that in. It's tough.
Sounds like a beautiful partnership you two have.
Yes, well, good luck on all your future projects, and thank you so much for being on Words on a Wire. It's been a real pleasure talking to both of you.
Thank you so much.